Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Alicia here, representing both the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast and the Lorehounds today, because I'm afraid John is under the weather. But fear not, I will walk you through the recap and lore breakdown, talking about those cameos as well. And then we still have one more finale mailbag episode to go before this Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, Lorehounds Acolyte crossover series, comes to a close. Once John's feeling better, we'll get his takes on the finale and season as a whole as we talk through all the thoughts and theories you guys have been sending in. After that, Lorehounds listeners are released from the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast spoiler policy, and you all have a spoilerific wrap-up episode coming your way on the Lorehounds feed, too. I promise it will be an especially fun one. Listeners to my silo coverage have an idea of what to expect. I have a lot of plans for the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast feed, too, from a chat about the Old Republic myths with Marilyn, to a walkthrough of the High Republic Phase 2 books with John and Jean, to dives into the origin stories of key characters in the prequel films like Mace Windu, Count Dooku, Jango Fett, and Maul. Stay tuned until the end of this episode to hear what's going on with all of the feeds coming up, including an opportunity for Lorehounds listeners that's closing at the end of the month. But first, we're here to talk about The Acolyte, the season finale of The Acolyte. Yep, the episode got the same title as the show, so you know it's the important one. And for the record, this was recorded on July 20th, 2024, and everything I'm saying now is true at the moment to the best of my knowledge, but may need to be updated later as the canon continues to get filled in. And apologies, this one is coming just slightly late. I actually recorded the entire thing yesterday, and then when I went to edit it, realized it was a blank file. So, you know, sometimes podcasting is fun like that. Now, just at the top, my overall thoughts on the episode. I won't get too much into reviews because I'll talk through that with John when we get to record the feedback episode. But yeah, I'm very happy. I think that this was a satisfying end to the season. I got more answers than I dared to hope. Yeah, of course, I will riot in a semi-respectful way if there's no season 2. I thought the Plagueis cameo was perfect. Obviously, we're going to talk about that in this episode. And I think that the Yoda cameo is well handled, too. I wasn't sure I wanted that, but I think that they did it in just the right way. And I would urge people to stop comparing this show to House of the Dragon. I know that they're out at the same time, but I just think it does a disservice to both formats because they are just two different kinds of shows. I do think that this is some of the best writing that we've seen in Star Wars, personally. It asks us to ponder complex questions, and maybe these questions are more complex than some of the audience is ready for in this particular franchise. But it does combine this moral grayness with peak Star Wars camp. We've got aliens, we've got compelling new characters that echo what we love about this galaxy, and of course, some of the most epic lightsaber fights in the series. So I've enjoyed every second of watching and analyzing this show. Now, today, for this episode, in absence of John, I'm going to let showrunner Hedlund weigh in instead via post-finale interview she's given. And don't worry, I know some of you think showrunners talk too much. I steered clear of anything that might be over-explainery, or there were some things that could be light potential spoilers for a season two, if that happens, in the Collider interview I'm going to be referring to. Just a heads up on that. But the quotes that I've sprinkled here throughout this recap is just some insight into Leslie Hedlund's perspective as a showrunner while creating certain characters or beats, because some of you I know, like me, also enjoy this insight, and it just helps us to think about the creative process and everything that's involved in it overall. So just to start, this quote comes from Hedlund's interview with StarWars.com, and it's about her goal with the series overall. So I think this is a good place to begin. She said, "One aspect that I was very interested in exploring in the show was, depending on the way you look at it, anyone can be the bad guy. And depending on the way you look at it, anyone can be the good guy. Nobody wakes up in the morning and thinks they're the villain. Everybody is doing what they think is either best for them or what's expected of them, or trying to fit themselves in a particular paradigm or ideal that is important to the institution, family, or place in the world that they find themselves in." Borrowing a quote from Mother Anasea, Hedlund adds, "It's really not about good or bad. It's about the power and who's allowed to use it. The theme of this show is duality and reflection, so the good guys also have to admit the parts of them that are bad. I don't see the Jedi as antagonists. I see them as flawed, and it was a story that I felt really excited to tell." And this is also one of the reasons why I particularly enjoy this show, as Alicia speaking again. I do love exploring the nuances of morality. And yeah, we'll talk more about what that has meant in this episode and this series in particular. I do think, though, that it's important that we're able to empathize with antagonists in the stories we love, because this teaches us important real-world empathy skills. We need to be better at understanding why people do the things they do. And we also need to be able to admit that the people and institutions we look up to are inevitably flawed. Nobody or nothing is perfect. And blind idealization is dangerous to ourselves and to those that we're idealizing, because this doesn't challenge them to get better or to take hard looks at themselves and where they may be swerving from their good intentions. Do also keep in mind, when it comes to the Acolyte, that this is the story, or at least a link in the chain of the story, of why the Jedi fall. And yep, spoiler time. Now that we've reached the last piece of canon content in Era 3, I can tell you the title of Era 4 is Fall of the Jedi. And this is, you know, this prequel series and the Clone Wars show and a bunch of books and comics and other things we'll talk about. But first, wrapping up the Acolyte, I've divided this episode breakdown into four arcs. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to recap each arc briefly and then pause to dive deeper into that arc with a little commentary and lore. So episode 8, again, called the Acolyte. This is the only non-paired title in the series, but I would say that makes sense because it's sort of the result, the pulling together of all of the ideas in the titles before it. The credited writer for this episode is Jason Mikhailov. He also was one of the credited writers on episode 2. And the director was Hanel Culpepper, who was the director of episode 6, which is where this one basically picks up from. So ends the tale of Verosha and Meho Anasea for now. Heavy is the helmet. Picking up where episode 6 left off, Osha is trying on the Kurtosis helmet. Chimer discovers her in the throes of an upsetting vision, and she lashes out with unknown power, turning his eyes black as she unwittingly invades his head in the way her mother could. But he struggles through it to remove her helmet and free her from what she's seeing, which she thinks is her sister, holding a lightsaber but killing Saul without it. She knows where to find them, and she's not telling Chimer, but he's welcome to tag along. So, this first interaction we see here, this is foreshadowing what we see at the end of the episode where she bleeds the kyber crystal. We'll talk about what that means, but where she turns her Saul's lightsaber red. And we're seeing that, you know, Osha's emotions are very strong and tied to this power that Chimera has seen, but we haven't necessarily seen as much on screen until this end of the series, especially this finale. So Sub-Zero, I just want to pull up one item from the feedback that's relevant here. Sub-Zero said, I think it demonstrated that she has Force Witch powers, and combined with traditional dark side powers, it would make her extremely dangerous. So I think that's indeed what it is, because, you know, she's going to be, we talked previously about the unpredictability and how that can throw off the Jedi, who are very institutionalized and used to doing things in a certain way. So this makes her, makes her and Chimera an interesting duo indeed, as if you don't know, the internet will tell you very quickly. So this was indeed a great moment for Oshamir shippers. People are talking about the whole quote-unquote man-wife thing of like where he lets her take the lead this episode, which I don't really love that concept. It's a little sexist to me, but whatever. But for me, the moment of real romance here at the beginning of the episode is where he's struggling through her lashing out with power at him to help her out of that helmet. And of course, when we get it off, we see the reflection of that red lightsaber in her eyes. But she thinks that she was seeing a vision of her sister. She doesn't realize what we learn at the end of the episode. She was seeing a vision of herself, which technically, I guess, we're supposed to understand her sister and herself are the same thing. That's definitely something we need a little more clarity on. I think when Saul says they're the same person, we don't... Yeah, does that mean that... we know they're twins, of course, but we know that further... They have the same Force fingerprint, which is just not a thing that twins should have. So it does seem that they are two halves of a whole complementing each other. And that definitely sets up an interesting situation for the next season where they basically swap places by the end of this episode. And of course, as Osha and Chimera leave the unknown planet, this is where we get our glimpse of our Sithy cave creeper friend, and he's looking exactly as I would have hoped from Legends. Granted, maybe a little bit older, but I suspect maybe he's looking into some rejuvenation. Now this is, we all suspected it, it's been officially confirmed, this is Darth Plagueis. And Darth Plagueis is an important character from Legends continuity, who's the most important Sith coming out of this age, and was the master of the most important Sith of the next age. So it was, very exciting to see him show up. And also, he's been confirmed in canon, most famously in the prequel trilogy, where one character tells another character the tale, the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise. Which is, if you don't know that, you can look it up on YouTube. John also recited it in his best Sith voice on our bonus episode mid-season. But this is a character who, again, like a lot of things, confirmed in canon but not fleshed out in canon the way he is in Legends. So we don't know, still don't know what aspects of him they're going to take over. But one thing that people were afraid that they might change is the fact that he is a Mune. That's his species. He's not a human, he's a Mune. And that's what we got. We got a Mune. He looks exactly as I would have hoped. In Legends, his real name is Hego Damask II, and he is a member, like most of his species, of the Intergalactic Banking Clan. Now, this is a clan from the El Barrio sector of the Outer Rim, and their home planet is Scipio, which is an ice planet with snowy mountains. But they also colonized other planets in the sector, like the more temperate, Munilist. And Plagueis' planet in Legends is the crystalline Maegito. Plagueis, the Munes in general, they have big brains, as you can see. They're quite tall. They have an average height of just under 2 meters, long heads. And they are especially good at math, hence the whole banking thing. One feature that they have that really caught my eye as soon as he showed up on screen here is they have the outer two fingers are a bit shorter than the others. And I don't know if this was like a detail in the Plagueis novel that I just, read over and forgot because, or if this is from some reference book, but I looked it up and it's true that the Mune are supposed to have the two outer fingers shorter. So that's good attention to detail. One thing that's always been inconsistent with this species is the nose. So we've seen anything from this very flat nose, like nostrilless, basically noseless face that we saw in this version, to a much more defined nose with nostrils. I definitely prefer the version that we got in this show. This is what I was hoping for. And yeah, glad to see it. Really need a second season for this and many other reasons. We know that Leslie Headland, the showrunner, wants to tell his story if given the chance. So I really hope that that does happen. So Plagueis, he's a smart Sith. I mean, a lot of Sith are, I have to say, on the smart side. And like many of the Sith that came before him, he was quite the researcher. The classic Sith theme, he wanted immortality. He wanted to find anything that would help him extend his lifespan, cheat death, basically. So he's studying midichlorians, force dyads, mind transference. You can imagine that Osha and Mei, whatever circumstances surrounded their birth, whether he was involved or not, we don't know. I tend to think not, but we don't know yet. He would be interested in any case, for sure. So Leslie Headland, the showrunner, said to IndieWire about him, "It was important in the figure's physicality and also the blocking of the shot to create the sense that Plagueis and the Sith aren't the armor-clad, visually imposing powerhouse villains we sometimes associate with the Sith. They're hiding out. The Sith, in this time, are fighting for survival." Headland and her creative team wanted to infuse him with a sense of graceful horror and make it clear, even at a glance, that this is a monster who wants things. And I thought that he was completely CGI generated in this version. If we get that second season, they'll definitely do something with mocap or something like that, so he can interact with people. But this version was pure CGI, and I thought they did a great job with like the way that the eyes just narrowed a little bit at the end as he was watching Osha and Chimer. Apparently, this was a complete surprise to even the cast and most of the crew, not the director of the episode, but she got let in. But the cast, when they saw this episode before, they just saw a blank spot in the cave and only found out, you know, not long before the rest of us, what was filling that blank spot. So, yeah, obviously, a lot of people are wondering if he is Chimer's master. And yeah, of course, that makes sense. Could well be. And then if that is the case, then the question is, has he sanctioned him taking on an acolyte? Is he interested in that so that they can find out information about the birth of these women? Or is Chimer taking on an acolyte behind his back to maybe train her up to help defeat him, which is kind of basically the Sith way? Or just throwing out there another possibility that I'm leaning toward personally at the moment is maybe he's not Chimer's master at all. Maybe he's Chimer's rival. Now, there is a Legends book, not canon, but Legends. So we don't know which aspects of this book are going to be brought into canon, but it's called Darth Plagueis. It's a good book. I've already talked to Deadeye Jedi Bob about it, and we're going to do an episode about that in the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast feed in a couple months. Basically breaking it down and what's in the book and what we think they might bring into canon. One of the characters in this book is a Sith wannabe, I suppose, called Venomous. And Venomous, he's not human like Chimer. He is a Bith, and the Bith are like the insecty looking species with these face folds. And that does play a role in the story because Tenebris, the master of Plagueis and Venomous, is also a Bith. And so Plagueis thinks like, oh, well, maybe Venomous is Tenebris's secret son, and, you know, or in any case, feels a bit left out for being a different species. So that does play a role. But again, yeah, that's all legends. So in canon, could be human. We still don't know what's going on with Chimer. He's made references to being around for a long time. Maybe this isn't even his original body. But yeah, Tenebris is confirmed in canon. Venomous is not yet. But one very interesting skill Venomous has is levitation. And that's something we've seen Chimer do a couple times, including once this episode. So we'll see. We'll see. Just throwing that all out there for your information. You decide what your theory is going into season two. But in any case, I'm more convinced than ever that the unknown planet is Baldemic from that novel. It just matches up perfectly with the Cortosis and the landscape and the fact that Plagueis is there now, especially. So I do want to point out, though, since I've acknowledged that it is known that Plagueis' apprentice coming out of this age is Darth Sidious. I've seen a lot of speculation online, and I would just want to point out that Sidious is in canon, according to the Timelines reference book, his birth year was 84 BBY. Now, that's slightly retconned from Legends, where they said 82 BBY on the Keeper of the Holocrons blog, but yeah, that's barely any change. In any case, that's 50 years after the events of the Acolyte, and I'm pretty sure Sidious is not alive at this point in the timeline, especially not as an adult, and I think that Leslie Headland, if she gets the chance to tell Plagueis' story, she's more interested in talking about his rise, you know, rather than that would be more toward the end of his story. Okay, moving on to the second arc in the episode, we're going to swap to the other side of the yin to the yang to the yin. Not sure which is which at this point. But on Sol's ship, Sol says that he's going to let Vernestra know to meet them on Brendox because he wants to show her the Vergence and the twins there side by side so that he can prove that that something unnatural happened with their birth and that their mother was scary powerful. And he hopes that this will exonerate him with a Jedi, but also I think probably with himself from the fact that he killed their mother. But May, she and Pip, they seem to be bonding, which I'm happy about. And she uses Pip to escape her bindings first, and then she escapes in a smaller ship. And she decides to plunge into the debris of a ring around one of the moons of Brendok. And that was, for me, one of the coolest visual experiences I've seen in Star Wars. I think, like, the coolest one I've seen since we saw the Eye in Andor. Saul, he's just desperate now, trying to follow her into the debris with his much larger ship. I don't think he realized that Basil was on board, but at some point he starts locking into May's ship, and we don't know if he's going to shoot her or try to, like, tractor beam her in or something, but Basil is not feeling the vibes and ends up sabotaging this control panel, and both ships end up plummeting to the planet below, but everyone ends up being okay. And all paths converge on Brendok. And in the burned-out remains of the Witch's Fortress, the sisters reunite in their childhood bedroom, and they confront their past. They fight it out. Mirroring them, Saul and Chimer have their own final confrontation. And Saul ends up winning, slicing through Chimer's saber. So, okay, before we move on from there, let's just go back and take a little deeper look at some of the details that happened during the sequence. So one thing that people are talking about online, I see, is that May, before she escapes Saul's ship, she yells out, "See you in hell, Jedi." And just to point out that this is far from the first time that word's been used in Star Wars, I think the first time comes from the original trilogy when Han says it. And we've heard others use, you know, taking the hell name in vain. There is actually a hell in Star Wars lore, although it's more often referred to as chaos or the void. But they say, in Legends at least, they say that chaos is also called hell by the Corellians, Corellia being a core world that is the home planet of Han Solo, and also other popular later characters like Kira and Wedge Antilles and some non-humans too. But yeah, so this is one of those concepts that's named in canon, fleshed out more in Legends. We don't know what's being pulled over, but the way it is in Legends, at least, is chaos is where the Darksiders go when they die. And basically, they get to just be miserable forever, stewing in their losses in the void. But like the hell that we talk about in the real world, not everyone believed that chaos was a real place. For example, Plagueis did not. According to the Naboo people, who we've talked about, that's Jar Jar's planet and where we're going to meet a Queen Amidala. According to their mythology, they say that chaos is a pit held back by six impenetrable gates. So this is a motif you see sometimes popping up in Star Wars stories when there's somewhere really scary and there'll be six gates around it. So yeah, I love that, like I said, that May is bonding with Pip now, the kind of the way Osha must have once upon a time. You know, I called her resetting him the most evil thing that she's done. And I think that, yeah, this is just part of their, maybe there's a sort of ebb and flow between the sisters in terms of, you know, dark-sidedness, light-sidedness. Or maybe she just realized how useful Pip is too. But the interesting thing is by the end of this episode, May, like Pip, her memory is also wiped. So they're going into this new situation side by side in the same sort of state where they've lost a lot, but they also have a clean slate. So they're going to be building their story from here together. So that's another thing I really want to see. So yes, this is also when Osha is using her mech-neck skills to get into the witch's fortress. And she's like, well, the only way in is to do this or to climb up the mountain, referring to Saul, of course. And Chimera's like, oh, really? And then we hear his voice echo away. That was him, I think, doing his levitation powers again to get in. And then, yeah, that mirrored fighting sequence was so cool. First, we see the sisters, you know, if they're the same person. Of course, they're using the same moves on each other, even though they've had different training and stuff. They think the same, apparently. But then we also not only get like their movements mirroring each other, but then the way that they're fighting ends up being mirrored in the fight that's going on between their masters. And it's also very noticeable. This is a scene where it really stands out that the girls have swapped their color schemes, you know, that they're really swapping sides. For the fight that's going on outside with Saul and Chimera, I just want to point out that Chimera this time, he is using Jarkai, which is using two sabers. And so he's got the long saber and he's got the short one, the Shoto. But he's not doing, we talked about before that he did Trakata before. When he killed Jackie, he did something called a flash and slash. And we didn't see him do anything like that this time. You know, we talked about how that's considered a somewhat dishonorable move. But if anyone actually did Trakata this time, it was Saul. He did the unbalancing block move, which is where you have your sabers locked with someone, like we saw here. And then, you know, he suddenly turned his saber off and that threw Chimera off balance. And that's how he was able to come around and surprise him and slice his saber off. So, yeah, it's considered dishonorable to do a move like that. But I also... can we really blame him? Like if you're fighting a Sith and or a wannabe Sith or whatever Chimera is, where do you have to draw the lines for yourself in terms of, you know, what you do or don't do to stay alive and to end this fight in your favor? Just one of the many gray questions that this show asks us. And I'll let you ponder over a quick break, and then we'll be back to talk about the final confrontation and the denouement and what to expect from the channels in the coming weeks and months. See you on the other side.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Okay, let's get into the final confrontation. So given the chance to execute Saul with his own weapon, May tosses his lightsaber away because she no longer hungers for revenge. She wants justice and she wants Saul to admit what he did to the High Council. But Saul, he admits to her killing their mother, not realizing that Osha walks in hearing this with shocked eyes. And Saul turns to her, and instead of apologizing, he's adamant that he did the right thing to protect the twins. And this confession, it pushes Osha over the edge. She trusted him, and he lied to her face for 16 years, raising her to believe his version of the truth and blame everything on her sister. And of course, she obviously had no idea about the killing her mother part. So she tells him to stop talking, and when he doesn't, she stops him from talking. Her anger not only leads her to force choke her former Jedi Master to death, but she, without seeming to realize it, channels that rage and despair into the kyber crystal of the lightsaber she's holding, her father figure's lightsaber, and the lightsaber that killed her mother. And when she turns it on, the blue blade bleeds red. The stranger we all know as Chimaer finally has what he wants, a powerful acolyte, and Osha makes a deal that she will train with him if he lets Mei go. And Mei agrees to a mind wipe so she can't find them, erasing all memories of the last 16 years and of her sister. Mei returns to Coruscant with the Jedi, where she is not as much used to them as they'd hoped, and Osha returns to the unknown planet with Chimaer, where the two look out across the ocean toward their future with hands clasped around her new lightsaber. So I thought that this was personally a visually stunning end to the season. And of course, yes, there is another scene we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the whole Vernestra arc next. But just, yeah, them standing next to each other, hands clasped, lightsaber between them, looking out. Apparently, they were supposed to be looking out in that way, you know, giving you the sense that they're equals. But it was Manny Jacinto's idea to reach out and hold hands. And I think that was a really nice touch. I agree that a kiss would have been too much at this point, but that just, yeah, it's something to show Osha maybe giving herself over to this relationship for better or worse. And I'm sure a lot of people think for worse, but definitely a lot of people want to see this play out. The fighting here was just spectacular overall. We got those, yeah, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon influences, of course. Manny Jacinto's background and dance was certainly put to good use. The whole thing felt like a dance together. Some of the most elegant fighting we've seen in Star Wars. So this is the part where Hedlund said she rewrote the finale because she thought there would be rioting in the streets if there wasn't a final face-off between Saul and Chimaer after she saw Manny Jacinto's screen test and training. And she said that his level of performance actually raised her own game as well. She told Collider, "Manny was giving this incredible performance all through this. So I'm like, how do I live up to this?" My wife asked, "What do you want to say?" I was like, "I want to say that people don't want me to exist as a gay woman, as a woman in this particular space working in this wild sandbox. There was a whole crew of people who believed in me, but deep down I felt like I am unaccepted for who I am because of what I believe and in wanting to wield my power the way I'd like without having to answer to the legion of people that just exist out there. By the way, I think everybody feels this way. I think that's why it resonates when you're honest about yourself and you get personal about it. When he says, I want freedom, that's what I want. I just want freedom. I want to be able to just be out there and be myself and be the type of artist I want to be without having to answer to anybody. That's why I feel so close to him." So she says that he is an avatar for her in some ways in the series. And I get that. And, you know, John and I have made the jokes about I use the term villain fucker. But what I really mean, if we're being a bit more serious about it, is just the idea that there is some part in all of us that feels chafed by, you know, what we are expected to be. And this is why we can often identify with a character who we may call villains or antagonists or however you want to put it, but people who fight back against expectations. And yeah, we definitely have a quite interesting one here. Not that we should, of course, emulate his behavior. Nobody's saying let's go murder people, but there's a reason why we are drawn to watching these characters on screen. Yeah, so we do see also both sisters in some way, they give up a part of themselves, they sacrifice a part of themselves the way that their mother said that they would have to when they were talking about the ascension ceremony. And in other ways, they reclaim a new version of themselves that they want to be. So first we see Mei, she rejects this path that she had been on by throwing away the saber. She says, you know, I feel like I've been misled. This is not what I want. I just want justice. In the end, she realizes all she ever wanted was justice. And yeah, also, of course, that throwing away the saber is a key moment. The camera zooms in on it. And at first, I saw the casing crack and I thought, oh, another broken lightsaber. Okay, so we've got two lightsabers down. Fine. And I didn't realize until we saw that close up of her clenching the lightsaber. And you can see, of course, you see the crystal is morphing from blue to red. but also you can see that the crystal is poking through the casing and touching her hand. And that is really key because the way that a Sith makes their saber and cannon, and this is a change from Legends. In Legends, they had synthetic crystals. And as I've talked about with John before, I love all the lore from Legends about lightsaber colors, except for the Sith ones. I much prefer the canon version where they call it bleeding a kyber crystal. We've had this described, bleeding a kyber crystal, a number of times now. I think the first time was actually in the Ahsoka canon novel from 2015, which is one of my favorite books. Definitely going to be talking about it on the Canon Timeline podcast. And then we've actually, quote unquote, seen it in some comic books, like in a Darth Vader comic book, in a Kylo Ren comic book, and also in the Jedi Survivor game, we see a character bleed a kyber crystal. And the way that we see it done in these cases is they take the crystal out of the lightsaber. They bleed it in their hand. I'll give you a quote that'll define that a little better in just a second. And then they put the crystal back. And when they turn it on, the blade is red. So we haven't really seen this like progressive bleeding up of the blade like this. But I think that that was a great visual choice, a great storytelling choice. And I really love that. That's one of the visuals from the finale that's going to stick with me. So as far as what the bleeding of the crystal actually is, I'm going to quote a canon reference book called Star Wars, The Secrets of the Sith. And this is a quote attributed to Darth Sidious, who again is the main Sith of the next era. And he says, since kyber crystals are naturally attuned to the light side of the Force, those who serve the dark side must follow a different path. First, they must seize a pure crystal from the lightsaber of a Jedi they have vanquished in combat. For the saber of a Sith is not given, it is taken. Then they must infuse that crystal with their pain, anger, and hatred, bending it to their will. This corrupts the crystal, aligning it with the dark side and making it bleed with unbridled crimson power. The bleeding process can yield unpredictable results. Some crystals shatter, making their energies unstable and unpredictable. Others resist their realignment, refusing to be bent toward the darkness. Once a crystal has been properly bled, the primal power it releases becomes not only a deadly instrument in the hands of a Sith Lord, but a symbol of their true strength in the dark side. So yeah, this is obviously the moment that Chimaer realizes that Osha is his true acolyte. And just in case anyone brings up a certain famous fallen Jedi from the next era, FYI, I said that this was in a Darth Vader comic, and people want to know why, when we see the scene where this character falls in the movies, why the blade doesn't turn red then. And simply, it's because, yeah, these conditions have not been met. First, it has to be the saber of someone you vanquished, which we see, obviously, that's what happened with Ocean Saul here. And you have to be touching the crystal, which is what we see. And also, I won't spoil that. but yeah, that's why in a certain film, when somebody does something, one of the worst things that anyone does in all of Star Wars, their saber doesn't immediately turn red because they haven't met those conditions at that point. It's something that they take care of later. And for the record, you can also reverse this process. It's called purifying the crystal. And after purification, the lightsaber blade will be white. So if you see someone with a white blade, which do turn up in Star Wars canon, then that means that they have purified crystals. We're definitely going to be talking about this in, there's a short coming up in the next, I guess the beginning of Era 5, actually, and then an even better book. and yeah, we find out what the killing without a weapon means. Apparently, it's force choking, which is not even new at this point in the timeline. So I'm like, okay, I guess, I mean, that's not a weapon, but poison is. Sure, I'll go along with that. I do still like the idea that destroying someone without a weapon is destroying the reputation. And we do obviously see that also happens with Saul. So I guess it does work both ways. But what I really want to call attention to here is that Osha demonstrates why turning someone away from a group or an institution for experiencing negative emotions can be dangerous. Because when this person feels like an outcast, they will seek belonging with other people who share these negative feelings, and that tends to amplify each other. And this is where we can get groups who can cause trouble, like the Sith. But yeah, we get a bunch of answers in the sequence, including we now know how May survived and got out. And that was actually foreshadowed, or at least set up in episode 3 when we saw Osha escaping also through these tunnels under the compound. But I just imagine May waiting by the tree for Osha for God knows how long. I really want to find out what happened after that between sitting next to the tree, how she got off the planet, and when she met Chimaire. But we see here a nice conclusion to May's arc for the season, because we saw in their childhood that she was the one who was trying to block Osha from doing what she wanted to do. You know, she wanted to cling so hard that she didn't want Osha to make her own decisions because it meant leaving her. And now, at the end, May asks Osha what she wants. And we get this emotional, tender moment of wiping May's memory. And I think as much as Chimaire proclaims to want to kill May, he does seem to have a real fondness for her. Though I think he definitely sees Osha as an upgrade. And we also see, that May and Chimaire both seem genuinely worried about Osha, worried that the Jedi will kill her like they killed their mother once the Jedi realize how powerful in the dark side she is. We get a little tidbit pointed out where the girls don't know who made up the rhyme that they have been saying back and forth all season. I like to think that they spontaneously generated it together. I've been noting that so far we've seen the rhyme going the same way, where in both cases it was Osha giving Osha to May, and in this case it was reversed. This last, so it was May was I give you, it was May giving May to Osha. So it really is, May is ultimately the one sacrificing the most of herself at this moment. I think it's going to be interesting to see if the scales rebalance in future seasons. And then May's left with the memories of an 8-year-old. So 16 years of experience wiped away. That's 2/3 of her life. This is a mind wipe on par with the one that we talked about in Knights of the Old Republic in that game in the second era that Revan underwent. Otherwise, I don't think we've ever seen a mind wipe this powerful. So this is far from the first impressive force feat that we've seen Chimaire do. He's obviously quite strong. But I think it also makes a difference that May let him wipe her. You know, she completely opened her mind to it. She didn't fight it at all. And also, it can't hurt from a real-world psychology perspective that they're standing next to the Bunta tree, which is the last thing she now remembers from when she was 8 years old. So that just kind of lines up a nice continuity to make this work better. All right, going into the fourth and last arc of this episode that we're going to cover, that would be Vernestra's mission. So meanwhile, while all of this is going on with everybody else, Senator Rayencourt surprises Vernestra with a visit, pressing his campaign for an external review of the Jedi. Vernestra finds out where Saul is, and she gathers Jedi Knights to seek a resolution to their investigation into the murders. And so she takes this team to Brendok, where she recognizes a presence in the Force that she thought was, that she did not realize was still alive, but she's too late. She finds Saul's body and realizes she has the opportunity to place the blame for the entire situation, pin all the murders on him, calling him a rogue Jedi who killed to keep the secret of the murder of the Witches of Brendok. Vernestra hopes this will help the Jedi escape Senate intervention, led by loudly Jedi skeptical Senator Rayencourt. And in the final scene, though, Vernestra turns to perhaps the only Jedi Master alive more powerful than herself. And at more than 750 years old, Vernestra's about 115, likely more wise, Grandmaster Yoda. And the final words of the season are, she says, "Sorry to disturb you, Master. We need to talk." So, first of all, I have to give a shout out to Mog, who I'm not sure if he's supposed to be Vernestra's Padawan or just her assistant. I'm inclined to say Padawan, but somewhere I saw assistant, so I don't know. But anyway, he's growing on me. You know, I called him like the Wish version of Yord. But the way he responds when she's like, you let Rayencourt into the control room. I look forward to seeing more of him. I do have to ask, though, what happened to Yord's Padawan, the Zygerian Tassiloa? that needs to be answered, because she was there in the beginning and then she just wasn't involved in anything after that. So I want to see more of her. Was it like difficult makeup, or why did she seem to get cut out? A lot of people, of course, in the sequence are talking about what Senator Ray in court said, because a lot of people are identifying with it, you know, not just in terms of what he's saying about the Jedi, but how it translates to the real world. So just to quote him quickly, he says, "I think the Jedi are a massive system of unchecked power, posing as a religion, a delusional cult that claims to control the uncontrollable." Venestra responds, "We don't control the Force." And he says, "Not the Force, your emotions. You project an image of goodness and restraint, but it's only a matter of time before one of you snaps. And when, not if, that happens, who will be strong enough to stop him?" Venestra says, "That's certainly an opinion, and not one shared by the rest of the Senate." He responds, "The majority of my colleagues can't imagine a galaxy without the Jedi, and I can understand why. When you're looking up to heroes, you don't have to face what's right in front of you." So yeah, incredible quote, on point in this world and the real one. But I do wonder, like, are his intentions as noble as they sound, or is it possible that he's being influenced by anyone? That's another question I'm going to have going into season two. About the whole idea of the Jedi and people worrying about it being tarnished, Hedlund said to Collider, "I think it's very clear that this is not a blanket, Jedi are the bad guys. It's saying, I think that you have too much power. I'm not saying you guys are bad guys. I'm saying you have too much power, and it's something that no one is looking into right now. So yes, I have a vendetta against you." We also see Rey in court taunt Venestra about her tummy in hyperspace, and she responds, "It's my head, actually." So a reminder for all the non-High Republic readers, Venestra gets hyperspace visions. This has been referenced obliquely a few times like this in the season, so I would expect it to play a role in season two. I also want to point out, just because the Star Wars databank points it out, that the Chancellor Drellick, who's the Chancellor leading the Senate meeting that Venestra has, his species is a Tarsunt. And we also saw a youngling Tarsunt studying with Saul at the beginning of the series. But Drellick is like the third Tarsunt diplomat or so featured in Star Wars. They're from a planet of the same name in the mid-rim. They look like friendly monkeys with long beardy manes and a lot of long face and big nostrils. But we don't really know much about them. They seem to have an affinity for politics and diplomacy, though. I think one of my favorite moments of this episode, though, relating to Venestra, is when she shows up on Brendok and she realizes, like, oh, I sense a presence in the Force I didn't think was around anymore. And Chimer gets his helmet on real quick when he senses that she's there. Oh, I saw someone somewhere suggested that this might be the moment where Venestra decided to lie about the whole situation. That maybe it's not so much about hiding about Jedi dying, but the bigger threat that she's worried about is them finding out about Chimer. Yeah, definitely. I think one of the foci of a season two that I would most look forward to is finding out more about her relationship with Chimer. But just to address people who are worried about changes in Venestra, the character, from the books that were set during her teen years. She was a Jedi prodigy as a teen, and she was quite idealistic. And now she's apologizing to the body of her friend, and she gives him a Jedi funeral pyre, even a floating Viking-style one this time. And then she stabs his memory in the back. So she may not have been revealed to be a Sith, but her pile of secrets is definitely growing. And now she's enlisting May, like, to help find Chimer, who she calls a pupil of mine before he turned evil, which is interesting wording because it echoes wording that Darth Vader's old master uses before to describe him in the original trilogy. So yeah, Leslie Hedlund definitely subscribes to the sentiment Star Wars is like poetry, it rhymes. We'll talk about the main theory going around about the link between Venestra and this former pupil, as she calls him, in the mailbag episode, but it does make me wonder if Plagueis and or Chimer might have already progressed in the mind transference experiments, because Chimer did say at one point that he was a Jedi a long time ago, and he doesn't look old enough to have been a Jedi a long time ago. So many questions, including Just a rhetorical question, but I'm asking myself, is Vernestra's betrayal of Saul maybe the biggest in the series? It must feel that way to the Soul Patrol. Marilyn, let us know. To me, this is indeed the real killing of Saul without a weapon. Even though Vernestra, she obviously feels terrible about it. She says Saul is her friend to May and describes him as a kind, brilliant, and compassionate man who did a terrible thing. Well, now Vernestra's doing a terrible thing as well. And what's worse, this is only making the Jedi sound even scarier to the Senate. So the only reason she would be throwing her friend under the bus like this is if she has bigger worries. So what does Vernestra know? Hedlund said about Vernestra to Collider, Vernestra's arc to me juxtaposes an arc like Osha's. Osha is so lonely and broken at the beginning, and by the end, she has really embraced this rage, almost feral aspects of herself to fulfill her destiny. To me, it was just so cool to do this tragic arc for Vernestra, which is that she goes from this prodigy, optimistic, inventive, and creating her light whip, her hyperspace visions. There's just these beautiful, specific things about her. And then to see her move into this space where she's no longer an adventurer, she has had to fill a role, which is to protect this institution. I think with Vernestra, her version of balance is that administrative, keeping everything together, making sure that there's protection around the Jedi Order. She's seen a lot of people go through there being the age that she is. I think that also speaks to her age, and I say maturity in her stature. I think that anyone who is part of that for as long as she is at some point evolves into it, like when a tree grows around something. I think it's just something where you wake up one morning and you realize you're that person. Which is, yeah, similar to how I've been reading it, you know, that often as people age, they grow more conservative. This is something that we see a slight tendency toward in scientific literature. And in this case, she's been through a lot, and that can make you more protective of yourself, of your identity as a Jedi in this case. So, yeah, I don't think it's out of character for Vernestra to be like this, but I do hope that she has a little bit, you know, that she comes out looking a little bit better next season. Fingers crossed on that. Another reason we need to season two. And yeah, I was not at all surprised to see Yoda. I was glad that they kept it that minimal last final shot. We just saw the back of his head and his ears. This is clearly then who Vernestra contacted earlier in the episode. And in the next era, Yoda knows about the rule of two. I think he tells Mace Windu about it in the prequel trilogy. So maybe we're going to find out what he knows and how he knows it. I know some people are worried that this might, like, quote-unquote, ruin Yoda, but I just have to say he's always been flawed, and he's participated in multiple cover-ups in the past and the future from this point, but always he does these things with his heart in the right place. Not unlike Saul, but Yoda does have the extra wisdom of many centuries. He's already well into his 700s by the Acolyte. We talked in-depth about Yoda and his species in the Young Jedi Adventure Season 1 episode, if anyone wants more information on that. And we're going to talk about him more in the first Character Origins episode in Era 4. Now, about the Season 2 that I keep saying I want, in terms of renewal prospects, we obviously don't have any word yet. I do think that there is a strong chance. Leslie Hedlund has said if, you know, people want it renewed, what she asks people to do is, you know, talk it up online, tell more people to check it out and watch it. I do have to say that hashtag renew the Acolyte has been trending on Twitter and Threads since episode 7 aired. So there is a lot of love for it. There's also, obviously, we've talked about it, we don't need to dwell on a lot of hate for it online. We just have to remember that the lovers and the haters are both just small slivers of the viewership. And there was a recent report that went around with viewing numbers, and they said that The Acolyte started as the strongest of the Star Wars shows, and it fell off in the, I think, like 30% in week two, 10% the week after that, went up a little bit later. But we can't really judge these numbers. It was comparing them to shows that where they had 12 weeks of viewership numbers, and there hasn't been 12 weeks for this show yet, so we're going to have to wait for that to make a final decision because, of course, you have to take into account, I know several people are binge watching it right now because some people just prefer to consume media that way. So we'll see. But I think, you know, this has definitely been one of the most talked about shows online, and that's not going to go unnoticed. I think our chances are quite good. And I think this is an important story to tell. You know, we need to know the origin of Plagueis. Yeah, and there's so much room for more good storytelling. So there is San Diego Comic-Con coming up next week, and some people are hoping that maybe we'll get a renewal announcement there. I honestly think that might be a bit too soon. I think they're going to wait it out, make us sweat a little bit longer. We do have D23 at the beginning of August. I still think maybe that's too soon. With Ahsoka, we didn't get the season 2 renewal announcement until 3 months after the show stopped airing. And that's pretty typical for other shows that I follow. So, yeah, we should just temper our expectations, but I think that there's a good chance. Now, as for what we'll be doing on our feeds now that The Acolyte is done, first up, there's going to be, of course, we're going to have the feedback episode where we get John's takes, and we're going to hear from a lot of members of the community and all the different reactions to the entire season and final theories and all that fun stuff. And then we're going to have next week a season wrap up. It's going to be on the Lorehounds feed and the Canon Padawan feed. And this is going to be a fun kind of game show style just to reflect on the season. And the spoiler restriction is going to be completely removed. All Star Wars will be spoiled. So if you haven't seen the animated series, beware. The next Star Wars coverage in the Lorehounds feed, well, I assume the guys will continue their film club when things are quieter. Things do seem to be quite busy for the next few months. But the next big live action show for Star Wars is Skeleton Crew, coming out late this year. We don't know exactly when yet. This is Jude Law, and it has a good cast. I just saw the list of directors for some of the episodes, and that's looking really promising, like the Daniels, who did Everything Everywhere All at Once, Bryce Dallas Howard, the director of Twisters. Yeah, it looks like a good lineup, but I don't know if we'll be doing weekly coverage because it is quite kid-focused. We'll see. I think it just depends how busy we are at the time and how it edges up with the holidays, but definitely there's going to be some sort of coverage there. It will not be covered on the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast live because it's much later in the timeline, Era 7. It's the same part of the timeline where The Mandalorian, The Book of Boba Fett, and Ahsoka take place. There will definitely be some Lorehounds coverage of it at least. No spoiler policy. We'll see what form the coverage takes as we get closer. And then, of course, in the meantime, on the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast, the content will be continuing. Episodes are now going to be released about every 2 weeks. And so just released this week, soon to be backdated to the Old Republic part of the timeline, is the Sith Legends of the Old Republic episode, looking at 3 episodes of the Visions animated anthology series. Next up on the Canon Timeline podcast feed in 2 weeks is going to be Canon Myths of the Old Republic with Marilyn. So it's going to be more Sith information in there, also some werewolves and a flood myth. Check the Canon Timeline podcast feed notes for which stories will be included. If you don't have time to read them all yourselves, don't worry. We will fill you in on what you need to know. And then following that, there's going to be 2 more Visions episodes looking at the echoes of the Sith in the High Republic. There's going to be mailbag episodes mixed in with those. You're going to hear from Bob again. And we're also planning an episode covering the High Republic Phase 2 books, comics, and short stories. So we're going to be covering Phase 2 first, because that's first chronologically in the timeline. And so we'll come back and cover Phase 1 later. Phase 3, again, won't be complete until spring 2025. Also coming up soon, there's Young Jedi Adventures Season 2, Part 1, releases August 14th, so sometime after that. I think probably Bob and I will be talking about that new part of the season. And also, like I said, we're going to do an episode about the Legends Darth Plagueis book, because that seems quite relevant for everyone to know, and it's a good book, so. And then, we've done these flashback episodes, we're caught up with the end of Era 3, the High Republic. Like I said, this is the last piece of canon content in the High Republic, the Acolyte. So it's time to start Era 4. And as I said at the beginning of the episode, that is called the Fall of the Jedi. That's what we've been setting up here. Era 4 includes the prequel movies and the Clone Wars show, But before we get to these, I'm going to dive into the origins of certain key characters, one episode at a time. So there's going to be an episode for Yoda, Dooku, and Mace Windu, an episode for Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, one for Maul, one for Jango Fett and the Mandalorians, and a mini Ahsoka episode in there as well. So I will release in the not-so-distant future an Era 4 overview with more details about what exactly is going to be included in that and what the Era 4 content or coverage plan is going to look like for anyone who wants to follow along and watch, read, or listen as we go as well. I mentioned that there was an opportunity for potential Lorehound subscribers that was closing at the end of the month, so I just wanted to mention that quickly here. And basically what that is we've decided to close our $3 tier of subscribers on Patreon and Supercast just because the amount of bonus material we've been putting out for subscribers has gone up quite a lot, and there's three of us to support now and all of that. So what this means is if you are in the $3 tier, which is now called the Lore Founders tier, by the end of July, so before August 1st, 2024, then you are grandfathered in and you can stay in that tier. Whether you do annual subscription or monthly subscription, you can stay there for as long as you want. If you leave the tier, if you stop being a subscriber and then you come back later, then you'll be asked to rejoin the next lowest level tier, which is the $5 tier, which we're now calling the Lorehounds tier. So just FYI, that option is open to you until, like I said, August 1st is when it closes. Okay, well, on the rest of the network, obviously, the big news right now is all of the House of the Dragon coverage. Jean and I have made our plans to cover the new Deadpool and Wolverine movie on the Lorehounds feed the week after it comes out. And Jean's going to be joining us for the opening of that episode as well. So looking forward to that. And I think since you're going to be getting another episode from John and I this weekend going through the mailbag, we can talk a bit more then about what else to expect in the near future on the network. That was enough news for now. But of course, I can't let you go before we shout out our Discord server boosters and lore masters. In honor of our Darth Sithy Moonskin cave creeper, the first melody is called Lurking. Thank you to our Discord server boosters, Gnarls, Aaron K., Tiller the Thriller, Dork of the Ninjas, Doove71, Captain Jinji56, and Athena Agilea. And thank you especially to our lore masters, Samartian, Michael G., Michelle E., David W., Brian P., SC, Peter OH, Bettina W., Adam S., Nancy M., Doove71, Brian 8063, Frederick H., Sarah L., Garrett C., Eric F., Matthew M., Sarah M., DJ Miwa. And of course, we're going to reload the music. Our next song dedicated to May and her memory, her loss. Thank you, Kwong Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T., Alex V., Aaron T., Sub-Zero, Aaron K., Dally V., Mothership 61, Gnarls, Kathy W., Stuart B., Jeffrey B., Elisa U., and always last, Adrian. Okay, thank you guys. See you shortly with John in tow for his final thoughts on the season and all of yours as well in that mailbag episode coming your way in the next few days.
The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds and connect with us on Twitter at The Lorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Jango Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear three full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to five pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.